This is BBC Radio 4 FM, where now we continue our Book of the Week. Doubling Back is the author Linda Cracknell's account of walking in the footsteps of others. In today's episode, The Heaven Above and the Road Below, Linda has set out to walk a drove road between her home and the Isle of Skye. The reader is Teresa Gallagher.
I approached the slipway of the Glenelg to Kylerae ferry on the early evening of the 13th day, hastened by an imminent Force 8 gale that might stop the ferry running. High winds were already whipping up a frenzy of waves and rocking caravans on a south-facing beach campsite. I put on more clothes and quickened my step. When I reached the rise above the slipway, I saw the ferry chortling crabwise towards Kylerae with a single car on board. It was fighting the formidable current, just as the cattle that were once swum across in the opposite direction must have done. A car pulled up, and a couple got out looking hopeful. I felt reassured. If there were accomplices in my escape from the mainland, surely the ferry would have to run. I was walking a 200-mile journey from my front door in Perthshire, across the mountainous wild land of northwest Scotland. "We'll get you across, don't worry," the ferryman said to me, "but we might not get you back." It was half my lifetime ago, perhaps in 1983, that I first went to Skye. I went with a friend Jonty and my ex-partner Neil. We had Jonty's collie Spot with us, and he and I were thrown together for company and unambitious walks on beaches and by waterfalls, while Neil and Jonty did the overnight traverse of the Black Coolin's precarious ridge. Back then, Jonty made shoes. They were boldly stitched with raised seams, just like Cornish pasties, so we called them pasty shoes. He made a pair of baby's boots, cut roughly from red and yellow leather. They were lined with sheepskin and held with large uncompromising stitches onto a thick crepe sole. They were both sweet and rugged. I somehow ended up with them, whether as a gift or left behind for safekeeping, I can't now remember. The boots have moved with me from house to house for over 20 years. I suppose they were waiting patiently for the time when I would have a child of my own to wear them. Those first days in September when I set out from Perthshire were the year's summer. My familiar places close to home sprang up, and the slight rise of Glen Merin took me northwards, hair dampening as I climbed into mist. The weight of my rucksack gnawed an ache deep into my hip joints. In the late afternoon, Glen Merin spilt me onto Rannoch Moor. My feet were pulled at by gloopy peat bog. I abandoned the preserve of dry boots and socks. For the first time on the walk, I was out of my comfort zone, wet and peat-splattered, travelling very slowly in an unknown land. I spent that night in a bothy I came across by chance by the water of Tulla. In the morning, sun blasted the valley into a tumble of white rock and blue river, and outlined the beckoning hills of the west. I took everything outside to dry on the grass. A heron at the edge of the water caught my eye. Then an electronic bleep stopped me. I had walked back into mobile phone territory. The phone had hung on to a message sent sometime between Glen Lyon and Glen Tulla. It was from my Edinburgh friend Cathy Jarvis, who I've walked and climbed many Scottish hills with. She's passionate about the High Andes and runs a trekking business there, but I knew she'd be setting out on a brand new adventure during my time away. Her message read, "Lewis Jarvis, born 10 a.m. today. All well. Kiss." I whispered a hurrah for Cathy and for Lewis, mentally threading another bright jewel on my string of journey beads. This one, though, seemed misted with a little sadness. The heron slowly mobilized its elbowing wings, took off, and soared upstream. Halfway through my journey, I crossed the Great Glen, a wide, ruler-straight trench that splits the highlands in two, linking North Sea and Atlantic. It was formed volcanically over 400 million years ago, and then deepened by glacial activity. it's still said to be slightly unstable. This rift also delineates the half of Scotland I chose and the other half that my ex-partner Neil chose. We hadn't lost touch since the final division 7 years before, but we'd avoided each other's immediate territory, and that avoidance of an area where I'd once spent a lot of time left something not quite resolved in my emotional geography. On day 9, I crossed over the Caledonian Canal and the Great Glen at Gaerlochy. I looked ahead, down Glen Agelin, which I knew as a kind of old back gateway into Glenbeg. I threaded on through the glen, aware that up high on that hill to my right, just hidden above the hazel wood, was the house Neil had built. I found him and his partner Amy in the glen, which they've helped revive from a time not long ago, when human life here comprised a mouse-infested crofter's cottage and 500 acres of sheep-impoverished land. Salad, fruit and vegetable crops now thrive in polytunnels. There's a sustainable energy business, small sheds where visiting friends can stay. I found remnants of myself, too. The foot-long young trees I'd helped plant now towered leafy and flamboyant over head height, delighted with the soil. Buckets of wet cement I'd helped carry for foundations had solidified and grown a house. But the opportunity I'd had to be part of this place, to participate in its fruitfulness, was long past. I'd chosen another way. Despite the kindnesses, the tea and food and drying off, the exchanges of news about mutual friends from university days, I suddenly felt the need for movement. I needed to reclaim the journey. I walked the remaining tight-throated 2 miles of the glen before it opened to sheep-cropped grass and shingle beach at Eilenriach. The big sky let me breathe. There was seaweed smell and gulls tumble. I walked towards the crossing point, the ferry to Skye. I walked fast. After crossing to Skye, I found myself tightrope walking on the cusp of the autumn equinox. I found shelter from the rising Force 8 in a Broadford B&B and thought about what to do. For the previous 13 days, the promise of camasoonery had gleamed at the end of my journey, in a sweep of bay under the Coolans on the south of the island. I'd imagined myself relaxing there in sunshine, watching birds and reading. But to include camasoonery meant another day's walking, and with the prospect of further raging weather, I was ready to call it a day. I could honourably consider my journey complete. After all, it had been my main intention to reach Skye. The next morning, Philip Tordoff, my host, stood outside the door with me. Trained as a church minister, he had a soft way of laying words, and I felt my path strangely blessed by him as he offered advice on my route. I walked off into a dry morning, and my boots strode me back into a rhythm. Rather than turning for home, I turned southwest towards Elgol, and the road rose to meet me. This was how I came to visit High Pastures. Strathsordale cradles the Broadford River, and there the lumpen mass of Beinner Calleach watched me as I walked the windswept valley. The hill altered a little in shape as I passed south. Eroded and rounded out of red granite, it framed itself within the doorway of Kilcreest, the ivy-tangled roofless church that sits on an ancient mound. The Calleach, the old woman or hag goddess, had been showing herself to me over the summer, cropping up in place names and folkloric stories, and in the names of mountains such as this in Strathsordale. I am not an old woman, and yet if you're considered old once your fertile years are past, I'm heading towards that different way of being. This journey was challenging my body, calling for stamina, strength, mobility. These were qualities of youth. Not much beyond the churchyard, near where the road turns west and northwest towards Torrin, I left my rucksack and followed the markers uphill. On the hill, or high pastures, a system of caves has concealed ritual mysteries of female fertility. Poised between limestone and granite, where water dives and vanishes into the earth, archaeologists are discovering the story of a fire kept burning for 800 years. Where daylight hit the womb-shaped cave floor, objects associated with the Celtic goddess Brigid had been buried. Around 80 AD, the site was ritually filled in, and the cave entrance topped with the skeleton of a young woman, the remains of a 5-month-old fetus, and a 2-week-old child. There were a few of us visiting the site, hanging on the words of the archaeologists. We asked questions, added our speculations to theirs, and then grew quiet. We were balancing at a season of equal dark and light, in a place where the world above meets the world below. I walked back down the grassy slope towards my rucksack, the road, the way ahead. I went on, eager to make some headway on the road to Camasunary. The village of Torrin hugs a low slope on the eastern side of Loch Slappin. There I sat out several heavy showers in the Blue Shed Cafe, drank coffee, had soup and toasties. In the middle of the day, a warm fug of travellers' conviviality steamed the windows of the cafe. After about 45 minutes, an elderly woman in a red cagoule arrived, and we were soon sharing a table, she encouraging me to eat some cake. She wore a blue jumper which matched her eyes, and she never stopped smiling. We talked about what we were both doing, her adventures that week on local buses around youth hostels on the island. She told me of her former love of walking, and we spoke of unconventional lifestyles. She paused and made sure I was listening. "I have arthritis now. It stopped me. But please, keep doing it," she said. "Keep walking for just as long as you can." And I promised her that I would. In this brief meeting, a connection seemed to have sprung between us. Perhaps I'd seen the woman I hoped to be in my 70s, and she'd seen someone she used to be. I began to understand that in her simplest form, the Kalich represents a different stage of life. I thought of this woman as my Kalich, and I no longer felt afraid. The line of this walk had linked places and people warm in my affection from a 25-year relationship with this part of Scotland. My journey took 15 days. It had been a period out of my normal life, and yet it had also been an intense period of my life. I'd set out to follow an old droving trail, but I had also opened up some buried chambers inside myself, and the walk had given me time to dwell on their contents. Back at home, I had little idea how to absorb the lessons into my everyday life, but the walk had identified one important task. Not long after my return, I went to meet Lewis Jarvis in Edinburgh. He had an old man's baby face, a double chin, and Andean sloped eyes. From out of their drawer, I'd taken the pair of red and yellow leather boots made by Jonty 25 years before. They were both strange and familiar to hold, after all those years growing more precious in the dark. Now they belonged to Lewis. It seemed appropriate for this special child born in the betwixt and between of the year that they should be his.
Teresa Gallagher will be reading the final episode of Doubling Back by Linda Cracknell at the same time tomorrow. The book is abridged by Sean Preece and produced by Gaynor McFarlane. Imelda May will be singing live in Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes. But first, here's John Wilson with a look ahead to tomorrow's Front Row.
I'm at the Hay Festival of Literature for a special edition in which I'll be talking to crime writer Lee Child about his forthcoming Jack Reacher novel. Warhorse author Michael Morpurgo and Gruffalo creator Julia Donaldson discuss children's literature. I'll be asking best-selling biographer Lucy Hughes Hallard about becoming a first-time novelist and musician Keris Matthews on being inspired by Dylan Thomas. That's Front Row with me, John Wilson, and a live Hay Festival audience Friday evening, 7:15 on BBC Radio 4.